Friends, hello. Welcome back. Thank you for being here. You almost didn't come. You almost didn't press play. You were going to watch another one of your pro wrestling matches and going to get a great show. Your opponent was going to get body slammed by your guy, and we appreciate you coming here. Susan, we're not going to do any body slamming, but we'll try our best to give you a quality time. Susan, where are we at in our timeline?
Wow. Well, the way I look at it with Joseph Smith, today we're on June 7th of 1844, which means we're talking about the last 20 days of Joseph's life, and we'll basically get through June 24th and pick him up next time for the martyrdom. So we're close. We'll see a buildup, and we hope we'll say some things that will be memorable for our listening audience.
Indeed. Okay, with that, I'm going to tape up my words here so it'll feel like I'm looking at you a little bit instead of looking down. I don't know the words this by heart. This is called The Unknown Grave, and it is a song written by David Smith. What was his middle name, Susan?
Hiram.
David Hiram Smith, that's right.
Yeah.
How could I forget? And he was, when our story today happens, that Joseph was going to Carthage, he was in Emma's womb, actually. So he was born after Joseph died. Yeah, it's called The Unknown Grave, so it's about where Joseph was buried. They were trying to keep it on the down low because, I guess, Susan, people were wanting to steal his body. And
there was some talk about that.
Yeah, or there was that fear at least. So they buried him in an unmarked grave. And so that's what they, and later they found where it was and marked it. Did they even move the?
Yes.
Okay, they moved him to where they are now. Mm-hmm. So here we go, The Unknown Grave. There's an unknown grave in a lonely spot, but the form that it covers will ne'er be forgot. There the heaven tree spreads and the tall locusts wave. There snow-white flowers o'er the unknown grave. Over the unknown grave. And nearby its side does the wild rabbit tread, and over its bosom the white thistle spread, as if placed there in kindness to guard and save from intruding footsteps the unknown grave, guarding the unknown grave. And there reposes the prophet just. The Lord was his guide, and in him was his trust. He restored the gospel our souls to save, but he now lies low in an unknown grave. Low in an unknown grave. Grant God that we may watch and pray and keep our feet in the narrow way, our spirit and bodies in purity save, to see him arise from his unknown grave. God bless that unknown.
Beautiful.
Thank you. I've heard that done by somebody and I really liked it. So
yeah, I like it too.
Okay. Well, with that, guys, it's your lucky moment because Susan is going to take us through this very historic time. Susan, please take it away.
All right. Our topic tonight is the road to Carthage. What you're seeing there is Carthage Jail. You're seeing a painting of the martyrdom there, And what we're going to do then, we're going to look at Joseph Smith then in detail as we move him now slowly towards that jail. As we do so, it's important to remember that by June 7th, 1844, Joseph Smith was a U.S. presidential candidate for the Reform Party. Recall, by this point, Joseph has never left Nauvoo on any kind of campaigning effort, but recall that he has hundreds of missionaries that have fanned out through the states of the United States. 10 members of the 12 are serving missions out there, trying to put forward Joseph Smith as president of the United States. The only two members not invited to be these political missionaries or volunteers were John Taylor and Willard Richards. So we know that about Joseph Smith. We also know that Joseph Smith was mayor of Nauvoo. And notice that Nauvoo is like a peninsula that juts out in the Mississippi River. As mayor of Nauvoo, he's mayor of one of the largest communities then in the state of Illinois, which Illinois becoming a state in 1818. We also know from the last time we met, as we talked about the women in Nauvoo, that Joseph then has organized the Female Relief Society of Nauvoo with his wife Emma as the president of that society. Well, with that, we're on June 7th, 1844, and we turn our attention to a newspaper that was just published on that date. Notice the name of the newspaper. It's called the Nauvoo Expositor, with the idea that the owners, proprietors, and I suppose editors of the newspaper, their purpose is to expose then Nauvoo. Well, what do they want to expose? They want to expose the mayor. They want to expose the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they are demanding that the charter that made Nauvoo a community in Illinois, that it be repealed. Now, obviously, this is the very first time that there's ever been a newspaper in Nauvoo that's been very anti towards Joseph Smith, the church, and even the city as a whole. What is surprising is that one of the owner's proprietors is a man named William Law, who just literally weeks before was sustained in the first presidency of the church. But you'd say William Law and others now joined together to print this newspaper. It comes out, its first edition is on June 7th, with the idea that it will be sent to big newspapers throughout the United States. They would then clip clippings from it and be able to use those clippings in their newspapers to counteract then the volunteer missionaries that are out there serving political missions to forward the campaign of Joseph Smith for U.S. president. Well, by June 8th, Joseph Smith, as mayor then of the community of Nauvoo, calls an emergency meeting of the Nauvoo City Council. One of the main men on that council is his brother Hiram. The purpose of the meeting is to talk about what to do about the Nauvoo Expositor, actually, especially not so much about him or the church, but the mere fact that they are calling for a repeal of the charter that makes Nauvoo a city. Now, for 7.5 hours, they will deliberate the issue. The issue is, basically, it's like a Bill of Rights issue, freedom of press. Does a press have the right to print whatever they want? And then, which is greater, freedom of the press, freedom of religion? I mean, you know, there's this huge debate. And by the end of June 8th, 1844, basically, the think tank there in Nauvoo, as it relates to the town, being the city council, does not reach a decision. And so it's like lame duck, no decision, there's no unanimous vote. They just discussed it and walked away. Recall by this point, remember we had a press destroyed down in Jackson County that was operated by W.W. Phelps, and now we're talking about how do you stop this breast. So no decision is made. We then turn to June 9th. June 9th was a Sunday. At that point, we didn't have any ward meeting houses or stake meeting houses in Nauvoo. And so where people would gather for Sunday services would be in what people called the groves. Most people on June 9th will gather near the rising walls of the Nauvoo Temple. By this point, the walls were considered to be a story and a half high, which makes them about 18 feet high. And notice it's just a shell of a building. Joseph had planned to address those that gathered around the temple, but was suffering that day from what he called lung fever. We might say sore throat in our language, but he called it lung fever. And so he asked his brother Hiram to then address the people around the grove. Notice in their Sunday meeting, there was nothing officially said about the expositor. But to be sure, there had to be men standing around saying, you know, well, what did the mayor and the city council decide? What are we going to do about the Nauvoo expositor? But nothing official on June 9th. We now go to June 10th. June 10th is Monday. Joseph Smith now calls once again on an emergency meeting of the Nauvoo City Council. The question to be addressed is, what do we do about the Nauvoo expositor? Should it be allowed to print with the idea it's printing wanting to get rid of their town as an official town in the state of Illinois? And so by this point, they have 6.5 hours of deliberation. So notice you put those hours together. It wasn't a knee-jerk decision to stop the printing of the press, but literally took 14 hours with Joseph Smith and City Council.
Susan, would you say how much of their concern was kind of the libelous things that were being said, and how much of their concern was the city charter?
Right. Joseph Smith had, you know, horrible things said about him, you know, up and down the Mississippi especially. And so it wasn't so much the prophet that was concerned about himself or even what they were saying about the church, but because it's a civic thing, it was mostly talk about the city.
Okay.
And so with that, 14 hours of deliberation, a decision is made. Joseph Smith will call in the local sheriff, a John P. Green, and will say to the local sheriff that he is charged with literally stopping that there shouldn't be another edition coming out of the Nauvoo Expositor. Now, John P. Green will carry out his duties. So we turn to the Nauvoo Expositor now.
And had they come out with one or two editions?
So they've only come out with one issue. Supposedly, the second issue was in the press and starting to, you know, to roll out. But the Nauvoo Expositor building was on one of their main business roads at the time called Mulholland Street, which is still the main business road in Nauvoo. And so John P. Green, believing that he needed help to go to the Expositor building to get it stopped, he literally went through town asking if anybody would like to be, in essence, deputized to go with him. Well, it's reported that about 300 men volunteered. And you've got a pretty small building for 300 men wanting a piece of it, right? And so they went down to the Nauvoo Expositor building. It is reported that they broke windows, which windows is always the most expensive part of any building back there, more expensive than bricks or the wood. They broke down the door. They went inside. They took the press out. They destroyed the press. They destroyed the second copy. They took the little type, you know, how you get the letters, put them out in the street. You know, an E would never print like an E again, an I. In other words, you'd say they did a pretty thorough job. And by the time they finished, and notice they're doing it after business hours, They now, as a group, head to the Mansion House. Now, as they headed to the Mansion House, Joseph had a little porch above the doorway, which is not really there now. They called it a widow's perch, where you could look up and down the Mississippi. You were looking to see, did your husband, a sea captain, you know, make it? And as these men are now mulling around Joseph's house, Joseph will come out onto that porch. He will have a hat. He will hear the voice of John P. Green above the crowd, his sheriff. And John P. Green will say to Joseph, "You don't have to worry. The Nauvoo Expositor will never print again." It is reported that Joseph took off his hat and said to the men as he's swirling his hat in the air, "Hurrah, hurrah, hurrah for the House of Israel." He will then invite the men to go home. In other words, the deed is done, you've done it, and the men head home. The next day, June 11th, you get the owners and proprietors now head down to Mulholland Street, this business district, and they're going to work at the Expositor, only to find as they're walking through the street, there's a press, windows are blown out, you know, their building, a lot of it destroyed, and the owners and proprietors will then set fire to their building. After they set fire, they will then run to Carthage.
Do we know why they set fire? Were they going to say somebody else did it, or what's their motive there?
No one has said, you know, what their motive was, but they set fire. Now, a fire at a farmhouse, you know, is out in the outskirts and obviously scary, but you can contain it. You put fire to a building that shares common walls with the next building or very close, like in a business district, you can destroy the economy of the community. You know, so was that their purpose? But, you know, a fire now set to the building. When the fire is set to the building on June 11th, and they now on their horses rush to Carthage, which is 23 miles away, and Carthage is a county seat then of Hancock County, of which Nauvoo is the largest community. As they set the fire, the smoke fire can be seen, and women are told then they, whenever there's a fire, like an emergency, the way you alert the town is that women come out with their dinner bells and they start ringing them at an odd hour. And that's your clue to know that you go to the nearest place, house, you grab some kind of bucket. So buckets are free for the taking. You run to the Mississippi, you load your bucket with water, and you form like a human chain that's like a bucket brigade is your fire department. And so what they would do, you have this circle kind of, and then head down to the river. One man would throw a bucket of water on the flames, and then he would then get in the line heading towards the river and another one, so you wouldn't have the one person kind of being torched the whole time and near the fire. Well, they will succeed on June 11th, putting out the fire in Nauvoo, which not only destroyed the Nauvoo Expositor, but obviously charred buildings close by. And June 11th comes and goes. We're now on June 12th. On June 12th, Joseph Smith is there at his home in Nauvoo. He's at the Mansion House. And coming to see him is the sheriff from Carthage. Now, Joseph knows David Bettisworth, the sheriff. In fact, as time had come and gone, he'd actually married that sheriff to his wife. So you can imagine that niceties are shared at first until the sheriff now hands to Joseph an arrest warrant. Now, for most of us, we'd be handed an arrest warrant. We'd say, "I've got to be laying down. Where's the bathroom?" You know, in other words, wow, life has dramatically changed. But for Joseph, as far as we can tell, this is his 38th arrest warrant. And so he may not have that kind of jerk reaction we might have. But Joseph now has had so many arrest warrants that he now reads over the small print. He can see where the fill in the blank, he can see his name and his brother Hiram. he can see the charge against them is riding on the streets of Nauvoo. That relates to the fire and destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor. But he also sees that it's on a printed form. And on that form, it indicates that he can stand before any judge in Hancock County. In other words, he doesn't have to go to Carthage. He can stand before a judge. Now recall that each of the wards in Nauvoo selected their own justice of the peace. And the closest judge to Joseph's home is Aaron Johnson, whose home still stands right down the street and I think acquired by the church in the latest kind of purchasing things as they acquire the Kirtland Temple and then several of the Nauvoo sites that were owned by the Community of Christ. So Joseph now sends word to Aaron Johnson, who serves on the Nauvoo High Council and local justice of the peace. And the question is, Johnson, can you hold court? Now, you realize we all know about lawyers and courts, and you got to get on a docket. It may take you weeks, months, years, to get your case to come forward. But for Aaron Johnson to hold court for Joseph and Hiram, in other words, the mayor, man on city council, sure, he clears the docket. Everybody else wait. Well, as Aaron Johnson now hears the court case, you get people who testify. Aaron Johnson indicates due process of law. In other words, Joseph, Hiram, you're not guilty of a riot. Basically, if anybody's in the wrong, perhaps Sheriff John P. Green, and deputizing so many men to help him stop, and Green not being able to control these men as they went to the Nauvoo Expositor building. But Aaron Johnson, in essence, says, Joseph, Hiram, you're free men. That nothing in your official actions as mayor or city councilman led to any kind of riot on the streets of Nauvoo or the destruction fire of the Nauvoo Expositor.
So what exactly was the charge or charges?
So the charge has everything to do with the Nauvoo Expositor and rioting on the streets.
Rioting,
yes.
All the men going through the streets.
Right. Boasting, excited what they've done, great to be a part of it. And then ultimately the fire. So the fire
was a charge against.
Right. Against them.
Them, even though the
proprietors had set the fire.
Okay.
So then we go the next day. We're now June 13th. June 13th, surprise of surprise, coming to see Joseph again is Sheriff Bettesworth from Carthage. In other words, he's gone home and now he's back. And this time when he's back, you'd say, what does he have? And the answer is, he has an arrest warrant. And it's an arrest warrant for Joseph, Hiram, the entire Nauvoo City Council. And what is the charge? It's the very same charge as the day before, riding on the streets of Nauvoo, the destruction fire of the Nauvoo Expositor. Now, we'd all pause and say, double jeopardy. you can't do that. They've already been acquitted, but it's a different time, right? Joseph concludes that the problem, perhaps the issue was he had stood trial before Aaron Johnson, high councilman, great Latter-day Saint. And so Joseph concludes, well, maybe I need to stand trial before Daniel H. Wells. Well, recall Daniel H. Wells, he had lived in Nauvoo before the Saints ever came. He was there when the town was called Commerce. And Daniel H. Wells was the man that gave the 4 acres on which part of it, the Nauvoo Temple, was built. So he's been a friend of the prophet.
But he wasn't a member of the church.
He's not a member of the church. But Daniel H. Wells will now listen to the trial. And you'd say you've got Joseph Smith, you've got Hiram, you've got the entire city council. Daniel H. Wells listens to evidence presented, and his conclusion was the very same as Aaron Johnson. Joseph, Hiram, entire city council, you are free men. that nothing you did, you can imagine John P. Green pretty shook, you know, about what has happened. But Daniel H. Wells says, you're free. Well, things are different for Joseph Smith on June 13th. And one of the reasons we know that is that Joseph now calls over young adult males. And what he wants to know about them is, do you have a horse? And can you go immediately? Joseph wants the Quorum of the 12 all back home. Those 10 members that are out there serving, Brigham Young's up in the Boston area with Wilford Woodruff, Orson Pratt, Orson Hyder in Washington, D.C., William Smith's in Michigan. Brigham wants them home. And you realize, different era today, it would just take a phone call, a text, Learjet picking you up. You know, in other words, you want them home, boom, you got contact, you know, they're home. But to the credit of these young adult men, they literally rode through the states trying to find the 12. But as they did so, they were not able to find anyone before Joseph died. And that's what's different, because the word apostle means one who is sent. And you'd say for Joseph Smith, Kirtland Safety Society, Liberty Jail, you know, extermination order. Yep, you go out, you know, hey, Heber, head to England. You know, that sounds right to me. You know, he's okay. But when does he want all the 12 home? It's June 13th, 1844. Things are getting serious. He knows things are different. Well, okay, we now go to June 14th to 17th. It's not like the days are all similar, but what happens in those days is kind of similar. The fathers of those young adults that are riding like crazy on horseback trying to find the 10 members of the 12, the fathers come to Joseph and ask, what do you want me to do? You needed my son. Can you need me? And if the father was 45 or younger in years, he was asked to go on a mission. And the place he was called to go on the mission was Carthage, Illinois. And you think, boy, if any place I wouldn't want to serve, you know, hopefully I'll call me on a mission, but don't make it Carthage. And their purpose in going is not to baptize, you know, convert, you know, could be a good aside, but they were to change public opinion about Joseph Smith and the church. And so in essence, kind of like our first public, you know, public affairs missionary kind of people, but to the credit of about 100 men, they said, you need me in Carthage, I go there. For other men, if they were older than 45, had gray hair, the question was, can you write? And they were told, write letters to family, write letters to government leaders, write to Governor Ford of Illinois, write to your congressman, and tell him that we need help in Illinois. Tell him what's going on. And you'd say for the women, if they could write, they were asked to write letters, or if not, you know, put your ex on a petition, get a friend to sign your name for you. We're sending this to Governor Ford. We need help. And so some people say, well, you know, I just don't know a lot about my relatives in Nauvoo. And invariably in those letters, they're bearing their testimony. I know Joseph Smith's a prophet of God. I know the Book of Mormon's the word of God. We need help. And, you know, if you need anecdotal information, what you're looking for is a letter that was sent out in Nauvoo. Never were there so many letters sent from the community, you know, except for June 14th to 17th, 1844. Okay. All right, Governor Ford. Joseph Smith will learn on June 18th. Governor Thomas Ford has left now Springfield, which is the capital of Illinois. Instead of accepting many invitations that were sent through these letters inviting him to come to Nauvoo, which he had never been there, instead of accepting those letters, Governor Ford has moved out of his home in Springfield and has taken up residence in the one hotel in Carthage named for Artois Hamilton. So Governor Ford is on the move, and wherever the governor is, that's his official residence. So Joseph now knows by June 18th, Governor Ford has denied an opportunity to come to Nauvoo, but instead has gone to the county seat of Carthage. At this point, Joseph Smith will don his Nauvoo Legion uniform. Recall, he is a lieutenant general. He will go outside of what were the walls then of the Nauvoo house. There will be a makeshift platform there. He will talk about his love for Nauvoo, that he will literally give his life for Nauvoo. He will lift his sword out of his shield, and he is ready now to defend the town of Nauvoo. And you'd say, well, why do they need to defend? And the answer is, people in Carthage and Warsaw are on the move. So you'd say for Joseph?
So on the move, like their...
They've got their swords, their guns, and they're setting up what's called a line of aggression. How you set up this line is that you take your wagons and you flip your wagons over with the wheels towards the outside, and then you have a box, which in essence, if you took off the covering, right, you have a box which you formed a wall about 4 to 5 feet. So I take my wagon, I flip it over. You take your wagon, you flip it over, and suddenly you've got this line of aggression. With Nauvoo being a peninsula, you've got water covers it on three sides, but one side is land. And so they've set up a line of aggression. Because we didn't have a line of defense, you look around, nobody's coming, and then suddenly you go, you know, pick your wagon up, move another 100 yards, we're coming forward, and we're coming forward, and we're coming forward. Joseph now asks for a line of defense. In other words, he will call martial law. He will say that the women, children, you're inside school. Remember when you went to school, it stopped. Private music lessons, they're stopped. You know, you're literally, you know, trying to figure out how much of the town you're going to save. And Joseph will say this line of defense, nobody can come through it unless you see one of the members of the 12. In other words, let's say you're a returning missionary. You can't wait to get home to your loved ones. Boy, if you're not a member of the 12, you are not getting through that line of defense.
Coming from the outside.
Yeah, coming from the outside to cross through. And so the only ones that could come through would be any member of the Quorum of the 12. So you got 10 men. The other is if there is any word from Thomas Ford. In other words, we're trying to protect our town. You know, governor, you're over this whole state. You're over all these communities that are starting to line up lines of aggression. Any word from Governor Ford, you break that line of defense, you let him in, and then you close it up. Okay, well, they're at a stalemate from about June 18th to June 22nd. On June 22nd, 1844, you've got line of aggression, you've got line of defense, and you have no man's land in between. And you'd say there's a lot of sabers rattling, there's a gunshot in the air just to let both sides know we're here, but, you know, nobody's shot, no one's killed. And on June 22nd, 1844, there is a military group that come through saying they've been sent by Thomas Ford, and that they want to see the prophet Joseph.
And Susan, so who are the men in the line of aggression? Are they just sit? Are they're not an official militia, right?
No, they're not an official militia.
Just kind of basically lawless, right?
Or lawless.
Or, I mean, Thomas Ford didn't seem to stop them, but
right.
They weren't anything. It was just a bunch of guys.
Right, just a bunch of guys, you know, thinking they're having a good time and. you know, certainly scaring than the people in Nauvoo. So on this June 22nd, 1844, Thomas Ford's men come across that kind of no man's land. They come to the line of defense, and because of the name Thomas Ford, we break our line of defense, and Thomas Ford's men, not Thomas Ford himself, are now taken to the mansion house where Joseph was. Now, at the mansion house, they indicate to Joseph's friends, notice Joseph at the time is upstairs. He's actually gone into kind of like a fake closet in a bedroom because nobody knows what the purpose at this point is of the military escort that are now downstairs. As the military escort comes in, they receive some kind of refreshments from Emma. She's always a hostess kind of person. And they indicate why they have come. And they have an arrest warrant for Joseph and Hiram Smith. Now, while they are taking some kind of beverages and eating, that arrest warrant will be taken upstairs where Joseph comes out from where he had been hiding. He now reads it. And on the form, it's the very same names. Joseph Hiram Smith. Charge against these men is a Nauvoo expositor. You know, the rioting on the streets, the fire, the destruction. And we'd look and say, wait a minute, third time. Joseph now looks at the arrest warrant. And what he's looking for is the loophole that he can stand before any judge in Hancock County. Well, it's on a different printed form. And the only judge he can stand before is in Carthage, Illinois. And at this point, Joseph Smith begins to sob. And he says, there is no mercy. There is no mercy here. And a decision needs to be made. Does Joseph go downstairs? Is he accompanied by the militia and taken to Carthage? And so there's a lot of talk, and the decision is no. And with that, Joseph now escapes.
So they would have, so did they not know that he was there still, or did?
Yeah,
or
they don't know. They're just downstairs eating and, you know, kind of niceties going on in the meantime.
And whoever brought it upstairs was one of his,
one of Joseph's people. Friends. Joseph will leave with friends. He will, remember the mansion house is bigger. Joseph will walk out through one of the wings, you know, a long ways out and then down through the kitchen and then will be out on Water Street. He will get Hiram and then they will row across the Mississippi River to the territory of Iowa. Now, they had been in Iowa before. Recall, we'd even had a stake over there named Zarahemla. So there's a lot of Latter-day Saints that had lived there and several that continued to live in the territory of Iowa. Many will gather around Joseph and Hiram, and the question is, what to do? At this point, the answer appears to be that Joseph had prophesied for years that the saints would go to the Rocky Mountains, and there they would become a mighty people. So there was a lot of talk about Joseph and Hiram going there first, and then when the rest of the 12, under the direction of Brigham would merely lead the saints to the Rocky Mountains, and then they join up with Joseph and Hiram. Well, it appeared that plans seemed to be getting underway.
And wasn't, didn't Joseph say, oh, I see it all clear?
Yeah, he seemed to see it clear, yeah.
He was like, hey, this
Yeah, we can do this. In other words, we've talked about it, you know, since August of 42. So there, you know, it seemed to be clear. But then the conclusion was, you got to take somebody with you that's going to protect you as you go back and forth. Now, the man that was selected is this man named Orrin Porter Rockwell. And Orrin had been loyal to Joseph. Recall, he's Joseph's friend, boyhood friend. Back in Palmyra, he's a man that gave the first $50 to printing the Book of Mormon. And Orrin, at the time, actually runs some kind of a saloon, a beer place, in Nauvoo, down the street from Joseph's mansion house. You'd say for Oren, he's loyal to Joseph. He's not much of one to attend church, so he's not, you know, advancing in the any kind of hierarchy of the church. But Oren is told Joseph and Hiram need you. He's immediately ready to go. The group stops by to see Emma in the mansion house to get food, clothes for Joseph. And Emma will now pen a letter. And as she does so, she hands it to Oren Porter Rockwell to give to Joseph Smith. Now, I think, you know, Oren, he could not read or write. He was illiterate. So she hands it to him. And as she hands it to him, Oren will now take it to Joseph. Joseph will read the letter by himself and then read it to the group. Some had been saying to him, you know, I don't know why you're making such a big deal about this. In other words, you've already been acquitted twice of any kind of crime about, you know, that stems from the Nauvoo Expositor. Just go to Carthage. In other words, don't blow this out of proportion. Don't go 1,400 miles to the Rockies. And in Emma's letter, she now encourages him to come back and stand trial in Carthage. Emma's had some interactions as president of the Relief Society with Thomas Ford. She has confidence in him. And it will be at this point and then thereafter that Joseph will now say, if my life is of no value to my friends. In other words, you're saying to me, hey, just go back, be in Carthage. If my life is of no value to my friends, it is of none to me. And then he talks about, although he is innocent before God and man, that he now goes like a lamb to the slaughter to Carthage. So at this point, a decision is made. Any plans to go west are now defunct.
He knew it was unsafe.
Yeah, he knew he wasn't.
He was getting the feeling like, I don't know if you guys realize.
Yeah, what I'm about to do here, you know. So June 24th, 1844. Notice he's going to die June 27th, but on June 24th, 1844, he and Hiram are up early. They cross the Mississippi River to Nauvoo, on a little boat. They're in Nauvoo by 6 o'clock in the morning. For Hiram Smith, he will now stop by his home to say farewell to his wife, Mary Fielding Smith. I find it pretty interesting that as he stops by to see Mary, they'll actually take time to read from the Book of Mormon. And you think, well, Hiram, things are of the essence, you know, but they take time to read in the Book of Ether. And while they're reading amidst sobbing, it will wake up Joseph F. Smith, who's about 6 years old at the time. He will go outside to play. He's playing marbles. Hiram will get back on this horse. He will see young Joseph F. They will have a discussion of which Hiram is saying, never forget me. I will die for the truth. And so you get the last time Hiram then sees a young son that will live to be a prophet of God, the young son then remembering words that he is to stay then true to the truth. For Joseph Smith, he will stop by to see Emma. And as he does so, he indicates he's in a hurry and that Hiram's coming, and their plan is they're going to get through any kind of line of defense aggression before, you know, people are awakened from their drunken stupor of the night before, and that he needs to ride and go quickly. And he says to Emma, he wished that he had time to give her a priesthood blessing. And he then gave Emma a most amazing opportunity. He said, write out your blessing and send it to me in Carthage, and I'll sign it. You know, so how many times have I said to my husband, you know, I'd like a blessing. I want you to say the following things. And you'd say, who is a woman that I know that had the chance? Emma did, but her blessing that she will send to Joseph is pretty, pretty immediate but is not, please help me to live till the 1870s, you know, and help me to stay true to the 1870s. You know, it's more the immediacy of the moment. Well, Joseph says farewell to Emma. Hiram's now there. They will get on horseback and they will begin riding towards Carthage. As they do so, and we'll end here today, they will get up on what's called in Nauvoo the Bluffs, out around by the temple. Joseph now looks over the community. They're kind of waking up. The day is starting. He talks about, little do they know, the trials that await them. And Joseph will turn to a rider that's joined him named Dan Jones, a young Welshman, and he will say to Dan Jones, I will give my life for Nauvoo. So I always think, oh, wow, you got to see Nauvoo. And, you know, for a prophet of God willing to give his life for a community. And we'll learn later on as we talk next time that June 27th, giving his life to seal his testimony of the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants. Well, what a great man. Truly praise to the man, right? But we close tonight having gone from June 7th to June 24th. Next time we meet, we'll pick him up by June 25th to June 27th of 1844.
I imagine that when Joseph saw the defense and everybody coming to attack the town, at least how I know him, he probably really did feel like, hey, I would, to stave off these people, I really would give my life.
I bet he was sincere.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, Susan.
Thanks, Clayton, for the opportunity.
Definitely. I was telling Susan before this episode, I just got back today, actually, from Kirtland. We've been talking about me doing going to as many of these spots as I can and doing some video for you guys and hopefully bringing some of this stuff to light and making it a little more real or whatever. All right, well, just gonna do this again as our close. There's an unknown grave in a lonely spot, but the form that it covers will ne'er be forgot. There the heaven tree spreads and the tall locusts wave. There snow-white flowers o'er the unknown grave, over the unknown. And nearby its side does the wild rabbit tread, and over its bosom the white thistle spread, as if placed there in kindness to guard and save from intruding footsteps the unknown grave, guarding the unknown. And there reposes the prophet just. The Lord was his guide, and in him was his trust. He restored the gospel our souls to save, but he now lies low in the unknown grave. Grant God that we may watch and pray and keep our feet in the narrow way, our spirit and bodies in purity save, to see him arise from his unknown grave. God bless the unknown. All right, guys, you've made a good choice to be here. You can go back to your pro wrestling now. if you have time still, but we've got one episode to go. It is it's a sober time for the podcast, just kind of not nearly as serious as it is the subject matter, I guess, but it's but we're getting near to the end of our little podcast here, so we'll have to see how it goes after, I guess, how well it's received or whatever to decide what we do next, if anything. So, Susan, you kind of bore your testimony of Joseph Smith, and I know that he was a prophet, and I know that he was faithful. There's a lot of people who thought he did things that were not the will of the Lord, and that he made some serious mistakes. And while he said that he did sin, he said they weren't the sins that people accused him of. And I know that he was a prophet of God, and I know that he was faithful to the end. And I'm grateful for him. Susan, your turn before we close.
Well, thanks everyone for listening to us. You know, it's sad to think that we're almost coming to a close, but I hope that your feelings about the Prophet Joseph, that your testimony has grown through this experience, and that you'll desire to learn more.
All right, guys, thank you.
And thanks.
See you next time.
Okay, bye.